these houses.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the very excellent Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. Today is the 23rd of February, and I'm just trying to look things over. Matt, do we have anything that we need preliminary before we jump right into the public hearing?
Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, I don't have any particular announcements. I think if you just open the hearing and
okay.
Well,
I will note for the record that Representative Nierman is excused. And I'm going to go ahead and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 5512, and I'll ask Director Allen to come back up. And you can just jump right in where you left off.
We'll do that.
All right. Thank you very much, Director.
Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, Patrick Allen, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. We have just a tiny bit of presentation left to do today, and that's on the health insurance marketplace. And I'm going to try to be a little bit cognizant of the fact that when I look at sort of at this half of the room, you've been hearing us talk about the marketplace seemingly monthly for about the last year and a half, and this side of the room hasn't heard anything about it at all. So I'm going to try to balance things a little bit. The health insurance marketplace is the function that we inherited from the former Cover Oregon, that is Oregon's health insurance marketplace under the Affordable Care Act, that helps Oregonians get access to insurance through the private insurance market. We partner with the federal government through healthcare.gov, so it's their technology platform, but we're a state-based marketplace, which is a defined thing under the Affordable Care Act that's important, and that the legislature previously, when you all made the decision to dissolve Cover Oregon, made clear that you wanted us to remain as a state-based marketplace because that involves a fair degree of control over our own destiny in terms of policy and plan approval and a variety of those kinds of things. So we are one of four states that uses this hybrid model of being a state-based marketplace using the federal platform. The marketplace function then is a reasonably small unit within DCBS. We've actually, from a management standpoint, combined it with a similar program, which is colloquially called SHIBA, which stands for the Senior Health Insurance Benefit Assistance Program. These are both programs that basically focus on helping people get access to health insurance. SHIBA focuses on helping seniors navigate Medicare. The rest of the marketplace program focuses on private health insurance through the Affordable Care Act. In both cases, what they're really doing is working often with networks of volunteers out in the community to help people make really complicated decisions, navigate sometimes complex systems, and troubleshoot and help resolve issues. I'm not going to talk a whole lot about SHIBA. It's separately funded by a federal grant. And its funding is discrete. So from a budget standpoint, we're really just talking about the marketplace that's part of the Affordable Care Act. You may be aware we just completed open enrollment for this year for the Affordable Care Act. We were concerned about what enrollment was going to look like based on rate increases that we had been seeing, and we're very pleased that actually our enrollment was up a little bit. 155,000 individuals signed up for policies through the end of open enrollment. That number will decay a little bit as we figure out who all makes their first premium payment and all those kinds of things. But we typically see about 85% to 90% of those people convert and become what we call effectuated policy. So from our standpoint, being prepared or concerned about a potential downturn in enrollment, we think that was a very successful year. Let me flip ahead to a graph that goes into a little bit more detail. As an agency, we're concerned about both on-marketplace and off-marketplace individual enrollment in the individual insurance market. And this stacked bar graph shows you that total market. The red part of the graph is stuff that's off the marketplace, people who go directly to insurance companies to buy their policies. And in 2013, that was the last year before the launch of healthcare.gov and the Affordable Care Act. And so that's all there was the individual market. A couple of things to note. You do see some displacement of individual market business off the marketplace into the marketplace, but the net total of the whole thing, all people buying individual policies, is up about 100,000 people. And so when we talk about increases in coverage in the Affordable Care Act, there's two big sets of increases, about 400,000 people through the Oregon Health Plan, and then the 100,000 people that you see here on the marketplace. our main mission in inheriting this, if I can be fairly direct, was to take a problem and resolve it and see that it gets managed without a whole lot of drama going forward. And I think we've actually been fairly successful at that. The cost of the system is down substantially from when it was operated by Cover Oregon. It's paid for by an assessment on insurance companies that's a dollar amount per member per month that they pay us. That assessment was $9.66 per member per month when Cover Oregon operated the system, with technology costs, to be sure, as a part of that. Today, we operate that system for $6 per member per month. The combination of our cost plus the charge that the federal government applies is significantly less than the 5% the legislature in statute had targeted as the maximum that the whole system was intended to cost. What we focus on then is working directly with consumers, helping fund and work with outside partners who are involved on the ground with enrolling especially hard-to-reach populations. And then we do an amount of fairly narrowly targeted outreach and advertising. If you haven't seen an ad from us, that's a good thing, because you all have health insurance. And if we're hitting you with stuff that we're doing, then we're missing our target. We're trying to narrow cast at hard-to-reach populations, populations of young people who we need to get into the pool because they improve the risk profile of insurance, those kinds of things. Sure. We don't do broadcast TV ads or anything like that, because we don't think that's a cost-effective way to get at those populations. The last thing I'll show you on this, in terms of a chart, this is the percentage of marketplace customers who are receiving financial assistance. There are two forms of financial assistance available through the marketplace. And I should say, this is all as of 10 after 1 on February 23rd. This is all up for change at the federal level, and we can go into that if you'd like, to the extent that I know anything. But the two forms of assistance are tax credits for premiums that buy down the cost of premiums for people up to 300% of the federal poverty level, and then what are called cost-sharing reductions, which are payments from the federal government to insurance companies that help people up to 200% of the poverty level with deductibles and out-of-pocket maximums and those kinds of things to try to drive down the cost of insurance. You see that the percentage of people getting assistance through the marketplace is dropping, and the interesting thing about that, it's because the volume of business of people who don't qualify for those financial assistance tools is going up. It's simply, healthcare.gov is simply a convenient way to go shop for insurance across multiple carriers, and we're beginning to see that now show up in the actual traffic. From a budget standpoint, the really important thing to talk about, however, is a relatively small piece of the overall package, but it's really important to the people who it impacts, and it's the COFA program. COFA stands for the Compact of Free Association. It's the descendant of the Pacific Islands that we were involved with at the end of World War II and then beyond through nuclear testing and other military activities and those kinds of things. COFA Islanders, those are folks who live in Palau, Marshall Islands, and Federated States of Micronesia, are allowed to legally be present, live, and work in the United States. However, as a part of the Welfare Reform Act in the 90s, if they would otherwise qualify, they're not eligible to receive Medicaid. During the last short session, you all created a program that you housed with us to effectively create Medicaid-like benefits that we administer through the health insurance marketplace. And what that really is a premium support program. We get them a policy through the marketplace, and then we add general fund dollars that you allocated in the short session to do that. What this POP represents is the continuation of that program and its addition into our base budget. When we came to you and priced the program back a year ago, in an abundance of caution, we sort of looked at the marketplace and figured out how many people could possibly sign up for this and what would it cost if they did. And if I remember right, that was about 2,000 lives that we thought could conceivably be covered in the program. And so that's the general fund allocation you made to us. Through open enrollment now, that number is, as you would expect, smaller than that. It's about somewhere less than 350 people that are actually signed up. And so what the POP represents is the money that was left from the original general fund allocation plus another $400,000 in new general fund. That's enough to continue the program through the 17-19 biennium, covering that number of people. Last thing I'll say about this is there's a little bit of a disconnect. These are biennium numbers, and the program, like all the other health insurance programs, run on calendar years, and so you can get a little bit mixed up in terms of what are you talking about exactly. But the bottom line is $400,000 will allow us to continue this program for the number of people who have signed up through open enrollment using those previous dollars plus the new $400,000 with.
Yes, Senator.
And that's for the biennium, $400,000 of the biennium, so it's obviously $200,000 per year then?
About. Correct. Recognizing that the last piece of the biennium is a half of a premium year, and so there'd be some need to be some discussion of if you wanted to unwind out of that, how would you do it at the end?
Gotcha.
With that, I'd be happy to answer questions on the marketplace, on the COFAPOP, on anything we've talked about over the last 3 days.
Any further questions for the director?
Then I would just wrap up by thanking you for your time and engagement over the last couple of days. And
too late.
Okay.
Yes, Senator.
I think for the record that it should be acknowledged that he's really dodging a bullet because our colleague, Senator Johnson, is not here. Wouldn't you say?
Absolutely.
She's got questions.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear any question there. But
you did. That's a statement.
And I actually have a portfolio of provocative questions from Senator Johnson, but because we've got 10 people signed up to testify, I'm going to hold those for offline discussion.
I appreciate that. I just wanted to quickly acknowledge the very talented colleagues that I work with who you've heard from over the last couple of days and the 900 or so truly dedicated professionals that we work with that I get the privilege of working with every day who help deliver our mission and make the stories that we've been able to tell you the past couple of days possible. And with that, we'll turn it over to CFO.
Director, thank you very much for the detail you've given us on these various budgets. We appreciate your time here. And Mr. Heath, you've been very quiet and very patient.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee. I'm going to ask Pat Allen if he could pull up the presentation.
You're asking for a lot of IT help here.
And if you wouldn't mind just starting it.
Yeah.
So I really have three things to talk to you guys today about. Really, we wanted to focus on just recapping the adds and reductions that were made in the governor's budget to DCBS, to do a quick comparison between DCBS's budget and the co-chair's framework that was released, which should be pretty straightforward, and then just to talk briefly about a technical adjustment. So really quickly, Pat, if you could move to the next. After that. Sorry, one more. So, in terms of investments, the things that we're looking at in the governor's budget are, the biggest one is requests for inspectors and consultants for the Oregon OSHA, and that's $3.2 million other funds and 16 positions. The next investment that was made in the governor's budget was the COFA Islander program that Pat just mentioned. Again, that's $400,000 in general fund, and recognizing that that includes $1.3 million in other funds that's rolling over from 15-17, that's going to help to boost that program. So the biennial cost is substantially more than $400,000. And then the last piece, there's two positions related to the regulation of the finance industry that are associated with or sort of conditioned on bills that have been supported by the department. One of them is for more regulation of the mortgage servicer industry, and the other one is for regulation of the
Mortgage loan servicing and financial advisors.
And the financial advisors, registered financial advisors. So in total, those two positions total to about 350,000 other funds. So those are the adds that were in the governor's budget. In terms of,
I want to get my arms around this. We were told $400,000 a moment ago, but the total cost of, and I'm all for the COFA insurance, don't get me wrong, but the total cost of that program is how much? You said there's an other funds of $1 million-something for 300 people?
Co-Chair Gomberg, Senator Hansel, the COFA Islander program was started in fiscal year 2015-17 with an allocation of $1.8 million in general fund. And essentially, the department projects that $1.3 million of that general fund, which for our budget purposes we're counting as other funds, is going to be rolling into 17-19. Essentially, the program had 6 years, or I'm sorry, 6 months of startup expenditures during the 15-17 biennium, and so the remainder of that $1.8 million will be available to be spent in 17-19, recognizing that the true cost of carrying on the activity goes up because essentially we've prepaid that amount in future biennium.
Yeah, to your point, it's about $1 million a year, give or take, on an ongoing basis, most of which we have left over from the current biennium. But if you were to want to continue the program in 1921, you'd be adjusting for, you know, inflation and all those kinds of things. You'd be looking at what is more like a $2 million biennial cost.
Follow up?
Yeah, so that breaks down, okay, let's say a million. That breaks down into insurance and what else? Staff?
Senator Hansel, or Co-Chair Gomberg, Senator Hansel, that's correct. There's one FTE staff position that's supporting the program. In addition to that, there's, and it's not just insurance, but out-of-pocket costs that are being paid for by the department with this money. They're sort of refunding out-of-pocket costs to some of the beneficiaries to sort of help drive down the costs of the insurance that's purchased.
What's an out-of-pocket cost?
An out-of-pocket cost would be like a copay or co-insurance charges that are associated with insurance that you carry that aren't your premium.
If I may, I remember what you created was a program that was intended to mimic Medicaid, the Oregon Health Plan. In the Oregon Health Plan, you don't pay copays and deductibles and those kinds of things. So this program buys down the cost of the premium so that it zeros out and then pays those other costs so that it becomes a program that financially to the beneficiary looks like the Oregon Health Plan.
So other members on the Oregon Health Plan would have the same, it's the same program for them as...
The net financial result would be the same, yeah. It operates, of course, quite differently.
Any other questions? Thank you, Senator. Please continue, Mr. Heath.
In terms of the reductions that we made to DCBS, really these were about essentially truing up DCBS's budget to its programmatic needs. The biggest adjustments were made to the Marketplace program itself, and this was largely because when the Marketplace transitioned from Cover Oregon in the 15-17 biennium, there were a whole lot of costs associated with running a large technology company, like Director Allen has mentioned, that essentially no longer continued. The biggest portion of those were for telecommunications contracts, IT professional services contracts. Those were reduced in the governor's budget. In addition, there was the ongoing cost associated with the litigation with Oracle. That those costs were also reduced in the governor's budget with the settlement of that litigation with Oracle. So all told, that was about $9.9 million in reductions. And this is not, strictly speaking, a programmatic reduction. It just recognizes the reality that the transition's been affected and the limitation is no longer needed. The other two reductions that were made, one was to implement the governor's executive order around IT security. A position was moved from DCBS to the Office of the State Chief Information Officer. And then two payroll positions that were doing payroll for DCBS. As Director Allen mentioned, DCBS made a decision to contract with the Department of Administrative Services for their payroll, and those two positions were taken out in the governor's budget. And then finally, the Department of Administrative Services charges all other agencies for the service it provides, and those charges were reduced in the governor's budget to reflect other changes that were made. I'm going to pause just for a second if there are any questions.
Yes, Senator.
Yeah, Mr. Heath, my question is, what is the assumption or assumptions that are being made in relationship to the federal government and that program in this budget? We've been told that there's going to be possibly payback, but I want to know, what is it that you're assuming the federal government's going to do to make this budget work?
Representative Gomberg, Senator Hansel, I'm not 100% sure. My understanding of the federal funds that DCBS has received are for grants for insurance programs. There's some money for operating Oregon OSHA, and then I believe there are some smaller grants for some survey work that the department does. The assumption made in the governor's budget is essentially current service level, which is that there's going to be a continuation of grants and things like that. Obviously, this could change, and I think that that would require probably action from the legislature to recognize.
If you like, I could speak to that as well, Chair Gomberg, Senator Hansel. We are assuming current law, but I guess would be the way to put it. And I presume that you're referring primarily to the health insurance marketplace portion of the portion of the budget. We really think in terms of plan years, because once a plan year is sort of dialed in, it's more or less dialed in. I together with some others, were back in D.C. last week trying to get a read on what we think is going to happen for 2018. With some exceptions, there appears to be a consensus around the notion of some kind of a phase-in period of time. And I've heard numbers anywhere from 1 year to 4 years. I think the likely period is something like 2 or 3 years of phase-in. I think that as we get closer to late spring or summer, particularly once rate proposals have been filed, it becomes very difficult to change the 2018 year at the federal level, even if they want to, because it begins to get really kind of hardwired into the system. Our plan is to be prepared to operate the program as it exists under current law, but also be prepared to make changes fairly rapidly in the event that law changes. We're having conversations right now about some legislation to, we have a placeholder bill in the House Healthcare Committee to provide some statutory flexibility to be able to make changes to Oregon's program that happen very late in the game after the rate filing process. Those could lead correspondingly to budget changes. We would expect, if we can't come back here during session to be able to discuss them, that of course we would do that in the interim and in February to make formal adjustments.
Please follow up. My understanding was there was a possibility that we were going to have to pay back the feds for a program that under Governor Kitzhaber had been implemented but never really eventuated. What's the status of those discussions?
Sure. Chair Gomberg, Senator Hansel, I'll be a little bit cautious because this is probably a question better for Department of Justice in terms of our legal position on the matter, but I would say two things. The settlement with Oracle was structured as reimbursement for expenses as opposed to a recovery for damages, and so our position would be that's what we received were reimbursement for expenses, and so there's not a, our position would be there's not a federal claim. In terms of the base grants themselves, I would say that our position is those were grants that required the submission of documentation and the meeting of the terms of the grants to receive the money from the federal government, and we did that and received the money. And so if there were to be a request for reimbursement, which there has not been to this point, we would suggest that we were in compliance with those grant terms at the time. Now, that would probably turn into some kind of an argument you can imagine.
Okay, thank you. Other questions?
So the next slide, one of the things that I mentioned was technical adjustment. This is a little bit in the weeds, but essentially when we built DCBS's budget for the governor, we took out all of the attorney general fees from the marketplace program and accidentally put some small amount of them back for their ongoing needs. We put that in the wrong place. So this is just asking the committee to recognize that this is... should be going to their central administrative division, is going to the central administrative program area, and it should be going to the marketplace program area, and to ask just for you guys to recognize that. Could you hit the next? So the last piece I wanted to touch on briefly was the co-chair's framework. This is fairly straightforward for DCBS because there really isn't very much general fund in DCBS. This is just essentially the COFA premium assistance program does not appear to be funded in the co-chair's framework. Mr. Stainer, if you could correct that, if that's incorrect.
I believe that, I'm sorry, Chair.
Please.
Chair Gomberg, members of the subcommittee, the co-chair's budget framework, I know you have it as a plan, but the framework is just that, it's a framework. It's a number of possible items that could happen. It certainly isn't anything set in stone. There are a number of talking points, for lack of a better word, that the co-chairs of the Full Ways and Means Committee have put together as possible reductions in multiple areas, and it did include the reduction of the $400,000 general fund that's currently in the governor's budget. But again, it's just as a talking point because of the shortage of general fund.
And just if I could, to make the point, this is actually, in fact, the only general fund money in our agency budget.
So with that, I would conclude my presentation and welcome any questions.
Any questions? Yes, Senator.
If, for whatever the politics or whatnot, we can't get that $400,000 back in, do you have, with that carryover, the ability to, at least for the immediate future, keep the program going?
Chair Gomberg, Senator Hansel, I'm just kind of trying to do some math in my head quickly. It mathematically, we would certainly be able to continue that program for the next year. I think we would have to try to figure out the implications of it being defunded on whether we should continue it for a year or not. And presumably, if you didn't fund it, that could be done in the context of some instructions to us on that point, and then we'd need to figure out some kind of a, you know, what does the next year look like.
Follow up. So what would you do with $1.3 million then? That's carryover.
Well, that's what we would use to do if we were to operate it for 1 year of the biennium. That's what we would use to operate it for the 1 year of the biennium.
All right. Any other questions? All right, gentlemen, thank you so very much. We're going to move to the public testimony portion of the hearing today. Looking at the clock, I'm seeing we have about 10 people signed up, and we have a little less than an hour. So if it's possible to keep our remarks to 5 minutes or less, that would be great for everybody concerned. Let me start with Mr. Parker and Ms. Dunn. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
And whoever would like to go first.
I'm Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee. My name is Sherry Dunn, and I work for the Building Codes Division. Today I'm here on my own time to talk about the work that I do with the division and what I have seen happen over the years. I've been with the division for 18 years. My current position is a business improvement analyst, which means I look at what we do to find if ways if there are, that we can do things better, faster, cut out unnecessary processes, and try to do the work we do in a better, more efficient way. When I started at Building Codes as a manager's assistant, the section I worked in alone had approximately 100 employees. Today, that accounts for almost our entire division. So over the years, I've seen growth and changes in our division. But in response to the recession in 2008, we saw agency staff lose 30 positions through budget cuts. At the time, it made sense because of the construction industry. It had slowed down, and our state was facing deep budget cuts. We eventually got four of these positions back in 2013 on a temporary basis. This was in response to an increased workload for plan review and inspection coverage in our two field offices. In 2015, these positions were made permanent because of an increased demand and to allow us to continue to provide timely response. Since the roughly 30 positions were cut, the division has been able to make back only 8 of those positions. Because so few positions have been returned to Building Codes, we don't have the staffing level to keep up with demands. We've turned away requests for assistance from local jurisdictions. Demand for permits and inspections have grown significantly over the last 7 years, and with it, the revenue the division brings in. As an other fund agency, we have the revenue available to fund, fully fund and support our division and to support increased FTE without increasing any impact to the general fund. My coworker Wayne is here to talk about the increased demand we've seen and what he sees as a plans examiner.
Thank you.
Afternoon. My name is Wayne Parker. I work for the Building Codes Division. I'm here on my own time and not speaking on behalf of the division. I work for Building Codes for 13 years now. I am a plans examiner. I review the construction documents prior to permits being approved and issued so that construction can begin. I work on the front lines and can tell you that the demand for services from the local jurisdictions is large. It's increasing. In Coosa and Umatilla County, we provide the full jurisdictional services as the local. In addition to that, we have IGAs with 10 other jurisdictions currently and potential for more to come that we provide services either through just plan review or inspections, or we provide all of those services for them because they don't have the staff to keep up with their growing demand. In addition to that, we provide services for all prefabricated structures that come into the state of Oregon or are built in the state of Oregon, such as modular classrooms. We also do special projects, such as the CLT projects out of Portland, which right now we're in the process of the third structure is in review at this time. We've also recently done a paper mill in Scappoose, and a couple years ago we did the prison and mental hospital down in Junction City for review, which only one of which was built. In the last 5 years, we've seen total permits grow by about 50,000. At this point now, we are not able to keep up with demand. When we talk about we're having to refuse some services for local jurisdictions that are requesting help, we can only provide limited services, which really does not help them out of their situation to get construction going. We strive for getting our stuff done in a timely manner. Because of the lack of positions for us to grow to provide these demands, our time frames have now grown on when we can get this done, which then in turn affects the economies of these local jurisdictions and the growth of Oregon. Because if we can't get the plans done in an approved amount of time, they can't get construction started. Construction doesn't get started, you don't have people working. You can't get the businesses open, they can't start selling their products, which then in turn affects the general fund budget. We're slowly recovering since the 2008-2009 rebound, but we still haven't been able to get the staffing level to grow with that demand for services. We need to make sure that we can respond quickly to this demand for growth by having positions available, readily available, that we can hire for in a quick time so that we can then get boots on the ground and get these projects underway. I know the budget situation is not great for the state of Oregon at this time. We're having some issues. But being an underfunded agency where we're 100% fee-based, we do not see that we would have any impact on general fund by growing positions and providing more services to better provide for Oregon to grow as a whole. I'll start with that. Sorry. So I see this as being a growth for our general fund budgets, and I would like to definitely see more growth in our agency as a whole to be able to do this. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Parker, Ms. Dunn? Yes, Representative Meek.
Thank you, Chair. Just quickly, so this is under the building codes section, or is it a-
Correct.
Okay, and so I just was curious where that funding needs to be proposed to.
Representative Root?
The other testimony that's coming is on the same agency, or the same part of this agency?
Well, it may be for a variety of different parts of the budget.
Okay, then I'd like to just make sure that I've captured this part of this one, if I may.
Please.
So this is not general fund funded, it's funded through fees. And they could be, we could be delaying the building of the homes and the commercial establishments that we need in the state for economic growth and to create additional revenue. Would that be a fair statement?
Mr. Stainer, you.
Chair Gomberg, members of the subcommittee. This is a time for public testimony. Okay. And the public comes in, whether they're employees of the agency or not, they're still members of the public, and they're coming in to discuss with you their feelings and their observations about the agency and about the budget. So I really don't have any.
You can.
Any commentary that would be appropriately placed.
I will draw my own conclusions then.
I would appreciate it.
Thank you. All right. But if I did, that's what I would say.
Thank you. Any other questions, Mr. Representative Reardon?
No, thank you.
They're quite welcome.
Comfort.
All right. Thank you both very much for coming down, and particularly coming on your own time today.
Thank you very much. Have a wonderful day.
Good. Thank you. I'm going to invite Mr. Marquis, Mr. Mullen, and Ms. Nelson to come on up. Again, welcome.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, my name is Matt Marquis, representing the Oregon Collectors Association, Mortgage Bankers Association, and Surplus Line Association. As you can tell, we have several clients that are regulated at the Department of Consumer Business Services and are here today and testify in support of their budget. This is an agency that, in our opinion, is very well run. It's an agency that sometimes we wish other agencies would look to for guidance in how they are have the ability to reach out to stakeholders on a proactive basis. And that's not to say that we don't always agree on policy issues, but we find a way to respectfully disagree at times, but they're always available to take input from stakeholders, to reach out when they have questions. I know you have short on time. I could give you lots of examples of where this has happened over the years, but I just want to express our support and our thanks for their willingness to do that reach out. Thank you.
Noted and appreciated.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. As I think most members are aware, the Oregon Law Center's mission is to achieve justice for Oregon's low-income communities by providing a full range of legal civil services. We've been involved for many, many years now working on health issues, going back to the Oregon Health Plan, to transformation, to Medicaid expansion, and so forth. This is very much in keeping with our mission. Most of the people that receive services through the Oregon Law Center are on the Oregon Health Plan. So when we were involved in transformation and we were involved in Cover Oregon, and we all know what happened with Cover Oregon, we were very much interested in when the role for DCBS was brought up and the change was instituted to move the marketplace over to DCBS. We have been very satisfied with how the marketplace has worked under DCBS, and I think that's probably very much a tribute to the staff, including Director Allen, making sure that this would work in a reasonable way in which would gauge both advocates but also those people in the community that assist people in understanding about how to sign up for health insurance. They've been very, very supportive of that, and we appreciate it. In addition, we worked with DCBS on a number of issues. The Oregon Law Center and others helped to create the Inclusion, Affordability, and Innovation Coalition, which is a mouthful to say, but actually our values are right there in our name. So when we talk about inclusion, one example is the COFA population that that Director Allen talked about today. And the whole issue about affordability are things that we've also worked on with DCBS. I would just also add that that DCBS has been an important partner on two pieces of key legislation to pass in the 2016 session, one of which had discussion here today, House Bill 4071, the COFA premium assistance. But I also want to highlight that we worked with very successfully with DCBS on another bill, House Bill 4017, which really provided the opportunity for DCBS to be the lead for the Affordable Care Act waiver potential under 1331 and 1332 of the Act. 1331 is a program called Basic Health that some of you have heard about, and 1332 is a state innovation waiver. So these days, as we think about what is now a role of DCBS for those of us who are healthcare advocates, we think that both having the marketplace there, programs like SHIBA that Director Allen had mentioned, and now with this waiver authority, even though we are at a place of quite a bit of uncertainty about what's going to happen at the national level, what's going to happen to the Affordable Care Act, we feel very much the case that advocates have a way of and an opportunity and an invitation to work on these emergent circumstances with Department of Consumer and Business Services. We think that whatever might happen at the national level, there will be an opportunity for state innovation. So in that manner, we have been engaged with DCBS since the 2016 session on discussions like these. So in conclusion, I'd just say that we very much appreciate the role that DCBS now has, both in terms of the marketplace and waiver authority, and very much appreciate the strong collegial and professional relationship we've had with many of the staff from the director on down. So thank you very much for considering their budget. As director pointed out, there's very little general fund dollars in there, but we believe that DCBS has done a really terrific job in working for people in need in the state of Oregon with reference to health care. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Mullen. Ms. Nelson.
My name is Amy Nelson, and I'm the CEO of Point West Credit Union, headquartered in Northeast Portland. Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify today for SB 5512, the budget for the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Point West is a community development credit union. We serve 9,700 members approximately in the Portland metro area. Our core mission is to provide financial access and empowerment to marginalized community members with a focus on serving the low-income sectors, Hispanic, Latino, and immigrant members, as well as micro-business owners. Today, I'm here to testify on behalf of the Northwest Credit Union Association and also the 21 Oregon State Chartered Credit Unions that are regulated and examined by the Division of Financial Regulation. During the recession, Point West was under a net worth restoration plan, and we would meet with both the state examiners and the NCUA regulators every 4 months. Janet Powell and her team provided consistent help and critical expertise to Point West, guiding us back from the brink of closure. Today, our annual state exams continue to be a cornerstone of our progress, and there's always room to learn, improve, and implement more so we may better serve our unbanked population here in Oregon. The difference-making commitment of the division demonstrates the benefit of a strong dual charter and a healthy state credit union system. They've done an outstanding job allocating resources in an efficient manner, but especially in our case, they also demonstrate resource flexibility in times of need, equating to good stewardship of the public trust. In 2014 and 16, I had the opportunity to participate in the rulemaking process and was impressed with the openness and transparency of public processes for rules, bulletins, and legislative development. The division was proactive in seeking public input during the rulemaking process and made improvements to the rule based on that input. This approach has fostered a competitive marketplace for sure for the financial products and services, also while protecting the consumer. And in particular, Point West is a proud supporter of Bank on Oregon, which is an initiative led by Janet Powell and the division that brings together consumer advocates, financial institutions, and community partners to deliver banking services for the underserved and unbanked. Finally, we appreciate the opportunity to engage, learn, and share at their annual CEO Outreach, which is hosted by the division. This event has grown over time to include state and federal credit unions, and Ms. Powell recognizes the division's opportunity to be a hub and convener of discussing industry trends and challenges on behalf of consumers. It's our hope that the division continues to have these resources that they need in order to continue achieving the good work they do. Credit unions and members across the state of Oregon depend upon a strong regulator who works well with those they regulate. Thank you, Co-Chair Gomberg, and the committee. We appreciate your service, and it was an honor to testify today. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Any questions for this panel? Well, thank you all very much. And let's hear now from Mr. Inlet, Mr. Powell, and Ms. O'Brien. I'm sorry, I couldn't read the first name here. Mr. O'Brien. Welcome.
Thank you. Representative Gomberg and members of the committee. My name is Joe Inlet, and I am with the COFA Alliance National Network, or CAN. I'm also a member of the Oregon Health Insurance Marketplace Committee, Advisory Committee. I am here to also echo the testifiers earlier who have said that DCBS has been a great partner in getting health insurance for many of our community members. They've also shown fantastic professionalism and inclusion in the way they've worked and run their committees. I am also a member of their COFA Advisory Committee, which discusses the COFA program. I do want to mention a few things about the COFA program. There are a lot of community members today who have lived in Oregon for 5, 10, 15 years who have never had any option for health coverage because the COFA citizens are categorically barred from Medicaid. And when this, when you all have passed the House Bill 4071 last year to provide for this program, this has been salvation for a lot of our people. Probably the biggest legislation win for our community in the whole United States in the last 20 years. So there really is no fallback plan without this. I will say that this plan is very critical, and we're in support of continuing this program. Again, I will echo the fact that DCBS has been a wonderful partner to work with. They have been able to make very complex issues simple and understandable for the community members and community partners, and a very complex system, I will say, in trying to implement all the pieces of the program together. But we've been successful in getting people enrolled, and I hope that we continue this program forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'll hold questions till the end of the panel. Who would like to go next?
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the subcommittee. For the record, my name is Jesse O'Brien. I'm the policy director for OSPIRG, which is the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, a statewide consumer advocacy group. And while I am here just representing OSPIRG, I would like to mention that I am the co-chair of the Health Insurance Marketplace Advisory Committee and a member of the Insurance Advisory Committee to the Division of Financial Regulation. And I'm here in enthusiastic support of the DCBS budget. We have worked very closely with DCBS in recent years to advance some critical consumer protections and services that are making a difference for Oregonians across the state every day. And we can attest that the agency really does meet the highest standards for transparency, proactive engagement of stakeholders and the general public, and a dedication to serving the needs of all Oregonians. And I know you have already heard about this from a number of folks, but really DCBS's efforts to engage all stakeholders never fail to impress me. I think they do a better job than any other agency in the state in that regard. So just to take one example, the insurance regulators at the DFR will hold parallel stakeholder meetings each quarter with the insurance industry and health advocates with the same agenda at both meetings to ensure transparency about DCBS's priorities for all interested parties. And I think that's a really positive step. And that those kinds of efforts have helped DCBS build the kind of trust and goodwill that have enabled a number of their recent policy initiatives, including on some pretty complex and controversial issues like the regulation of health insurance networks, to make progress on a consensus or something close to a consensus basis, which I think is an impressive accomplishment. My organization has had the opportunity to partner with DCBS over the past several years to provide a voice for Oregon consumers in the state's health insurance rate review process. And throughout that period, DCBS demonstrated its commitment to continuously strengthening scrutiny of health insurance rate proposals, to expand their efforts to hold insurers more accountable for cost containment and quality improvement efforts, and to make the review process itself as open and accountable as possible, all while, in our estimation, helping to cut about $200 million during that period in unjustified costs from health insurance premiums for Oregon consumers and small businesses. And while the grant that enabled the specific partnership that we had with DCBS has been repurposed by the federal government, we have no doubt that they'll continue to be a national leader in this area. I talked to advocates in other states who work on issues having to do with health insurance rates, and everybody looks to what we do here in Oregon. You've heard a lot about the health insurance marketplace today. I'll just say that since DCBS took over the program in 2015, they've managed a once-troubled program with what I think is great effectiveness. They've overseen significant enrollment increases in both of the past couple of years. They have implemented, as you've heard, a first-in-the-nation, really innovative coverage program for Oregonians from the Compact of Free Association Nations, and they've provided invaluable real-time support to consumers all over the state. And although this work has really received only the tiniest fraction of the public attention that the difficulties that the marketplace faced in previous years, I think it's an important success story and it deserves to be told. In a time of uncertainty about the future of health reform at the national level, the marketplace work is really going to face some pretty unique challenges in the years to come, and I think it's critical to ensure that the department can continue to do everything it can to help Oregonians connect with affordable health coverage, and that takes resources. Across the board, I think DCBS's consumer protection programs are only going to grow in importance in the coming years. There is, widespread uncertainty about the federal government's commitment to its own consumer protection responsibilities through agencies like the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And we think it's in that context, it's absolutely essential that Oregon consumers have a strong champion at the state level. So we urge you to support DCBS's budget for that reason. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. O'Brien. Mr. Powell, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is John Powell. The firm I'm a member of represents virtually insurers that write almost all lines of insurance. So we interact with the insurance division under DCBS all the time. There's two paradigms when it comes to the insurance division's budget that concerns insurers. One is the money side, and the I think you've got a sense of the frugalness of the budgeting at DCBS. They're very careful with the dollar, and it's important to insurers because it's basically a fee-based regulation whereby insurers are assessed to pay for that regulation. So they care about that and are happy with how frugal the budgeting has been through that department. The other paradigm is power. When it comes to regulating a business, there is no more powerful entity in the United States of America than an insurance division. They can take any insurance agent's license, they can fine them, they take any insurance company's license, and they can fine them. And I'm not talking about $5 fines, I'm talking about $100,000 fines. They're very, very powerful. Their statute is overwhelmingly powerful. They can do basically anything they want and demand any information they want. So on the one hand, we're concerned about the money and that they have enough to do the job because we want our competitors regulated for a fair marketplace, and they do that very well. On the other hand, we want people in that organization who are fair all the way around. And I think they do a better job of people managing than any agency. And I think Mr. Marquis had mentioned that. We wish all agencies of government had the quality of people. You've gotten to know Mr. Allen. I don't have to say anything. He's sharp. He's a very, very good recruiter. The people in that agency that have the power are extremely bright, and they're very, very fair. From Laura Calley, the insurance commissioner now has banking as well as insurance. Lou Savage at workers' compensation. Just people who will go out of their way to let everybody know what's going on, from advocates for the consumer to insurers. So it's with that balance that we urge support for this budget, and in fact, a kudo to the people who run the agency. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for the witnesses? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony. I'd like to call Kevin Christensen, Justin Delaney, and Graham Traird. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chairman Rowe, members of the committee. My name is Kevin Christensen. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Oregon Bankers Association. It's a pleasure to be before you today. We are here in support of DCBS's budget. We're primarily an organization that we're a full-service trade organization for state and nationally chartered banks in the state of Oregon. I think currently, and I say currently because there has been merger activity going on, I believe we have approximately 42 members. Of those, there are 23 banks that are headquartered here in Oregon, and I believe 19 of those are actually state-chartered organizations. So we have a nice group of folks who run the banking community here in the state. And as I indicated, it's a pleasure to be before you and speak on behalf of the industry. My testimony, I want to probably highlight two primary things. First of all, engagement, and second of all, the transparency with respect to DCBS. You've heard from plenty of other folks who've talked about the personnel. You know, I could talk about Director Allen, Commissioner Robinson, and some of the other folks They do a wonderful job of providing guidance. But just a couple of examples. In terms of rulemaking and legislation and the engagement piece, they're really second to none when it comes down to the agencies that are working. We feel like, although we don't always agree with the agency on particular issues, as you can imagine, we have a very good working relationship where I think there's a frank give and take between us, the positions that we're articulating, and the folks who work at DCBS. Sometimes with other agencies, if you file a comment letter, for instance, and it seems to go into a black hole, you never hear anything. I'll get a phone call or a call later in the evening going, hey, I want to check subpart B, little 2. What did you mean by that? And that's the kind of engagement, especially in a heavily regulated industry, that we really need. And again, we don't always agree. But as a practical matter, I don't think there's a time when we're sitting back and questioning whether or not we're being heard and that there's given full vetting of the issues that we come forward with. Same thing with legislation. I won't bore you like we did in 2015 with a 70-80-page Bank Act rewrite bill and modernization. Thank you for your votes on that. I'm sure it was a sleeper because something only lawyers can probably love. But we spent a fair amount of time and we were hand in glove with the agency making sure that if we were making changes that it was something that we could reach consensus on, and I believe we had a good product that came out of that. So that's a couple of examples. Number two, both an engagement but also what I would characterize as the transparency, and that's the recent merger of insurance and the Department of Corporate Securities and Finance. I think it went well. We were engaged in that process. Input from not only our association, more importantly our banks, was sought, and I think I understood there was a good give and take, and I think we are approximately, 14 months later, I think the overall process has been good, and we're pleased by the accountability, knowing where the fees are going, and I think an understanding from the department that this, especially in a time in which there's been a fair amount of consolidation within the banking industry, that they need to, every penny's precious, if you will. And we believe that they respect that. There's transparency and, again, a good oiled organization. Finally, just in terms of our members going above and beyond, we have a couple of activities that we do. First of all, FDIC and DFR do have what they call our CEO outreach, which is a chance for both regulators to come together, talk to our CEOs directly about here trends, here concerns, things like that. Again, have that dialogue so that folks know where they're coming from. And then finally, I also hear on behalf of the Independent Community Banks of Oregon, which is part of our organization, and we've been very fortunate twice a year we have our board, that Independent Community Banks board, come together with folks. Jacob Mudnaden comes over, and again, it's that information sharing. So there's lots of different touch points beyond just what happens here in the building or rulemaking. So again, it's a pleasure to speak in support of the agency, and I'm happy to answer any questions folks have.
Thank you so very much.
No, you go. You may go first.
Good afternoon, Chair Gomberg, members of the committee. I'm Justin Delaney. I'm the vice president at Standard Insurance Company. We are Oregon's largest headquartered insurance company, 110 years old, and we have 3,000 employees. The majority of those are here in Oregon. I'm happy to speak to you today in support of the DCBS budget. I'm going to run through a couple things. More than anything, though, I wanted to convey to you, I do this job nationwide. Regulatory matters is one of my responsibilities. If you had any questions about how our insurance regulator compares to other states, I'd be happy to attempt to respond to those. I view the insurance division in DCBS as having two main missions. One is consumer protection. The other is company protection. It's vitally important that insurance companies remain solvent. And it, when I say that, I don't say that necessarily from a Standard Insurance Company perspective, but I have another role here in Oregon. I chair what is called the Oregon Life and Health Guarantee Association. When an insurer goes insolvent anywhere in the country, they call us and tell us, here's what your association owes to cover those claims for the next 5, 10, 50 years. We have to assess our members to pay those, our members or other insurance companies. So it's not a happy call when that happens. It's incumbent on the regulators to have the sophistication and the bandwidth to monitor the solvency of insurance companies. And we're not easy companies to audit and to look at, but the division does a very good job. And in fact, we just finished our large financial examination with the insurance division. And I can tell you, it takes a fleet of them. They need the bandwidth to be able to do these important functions. Other than solvency, consumer advocacy is very important. They have a staff of folks that handles consumer complaints. We tell our customers, if they're not happy with our decision, you can call the insurance division, and they'll take this matter up for you. That is vitally important for a couple of reasons. One, oftentimes, you know, I happen to like insurance companies, but I've heard that a lot of people don't. Sometimes a customer is not going to agree with us no matter how many times we explain the claim decision. The division inserts itself as a neutral arbiter with a consumer, and that is incredibly helpful. Sometimes they will thank the division, come back to us and say, I understand now. Other times the division tells us, hey, Standard, I think you're wrong. We need to talk about this. The last point, back to bandwidth, really, the division in the last several years has had an unusual amount of activity around mergers and acquisitions of insurance companies. And much like monitoring the solvency of an insurance company, that's really complicated. The division has to go through an analysis of the acquisition, make sure that Oregon consumers are being taken care of, and they can't anticipate when those are going to happen by the nature of the beast, but they have to be prepared and ready to review and approve those mergers and acquisitions. And they did, when our parent company was purchased a year and a half ago, they were certainly stretched on bandwidth, but we got there. And at the end of the day, I came away really appreciating their expertise, their transparency, and just their ability to talk to you in plain English when you need it. In closing, I'd say that from my perspective, doing this in 50 states, they are a competitive regulator. There are some around the country that are very difficult to deal with. Those regulators tend to lose companies, headquartered companies. I won't name states, but there's one down south that's lost most of its headquartered insurers because of an insurance regulator that is very aggressive. Ours is firm but transparent, and they're a pleasure to work with, and I wholeheartedly support their budget request this year. Thank you.
And thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, my name is Graham Traynor, representing the over 300,000 working Oregonians of the Oregon AFL-CIO, and thanks for the opportunity to share a few brief supportive remarks from the perspective of a worker on the Workers' Compensation Division element of the DCBS budget. The Oregon AFL-CIO has been a long-term advocate for greater worker protections and structures that make Oregon a safer and more fair place to work, and we continue to be a voice for all workers in this legislative process. As you all are, I'm sure, very familiar with, Oregon's workers' comp system has not always been one that workers can be proud of. In 1989, as you all know, Oregon's system ranked the highest in the country for workplace injury claims resulting in disability. At the same time, it wasn't working for employers or insurers either, with the sixth highest premium costs in the country and the third highest in total medical costs per claim. Due to the Mahonia-Hall reforms, our workers' comp system was put on a much more sustainable path, balancing worker benefits with employer rates, establishing successful safety programs to reduce workplace injuries, all while improving worker benefits. Today, at a time when some workers' comp systems around the country are facing wildly imbalanced realities, we now have a greatly improved system by every measure, including worker injuries and employer rates. At the Oregon AFL-CIO, we believe that this balanced workers' comp system is partly due to the guidance and thorough vetting that MLAC, the Management Labor Advisory Committee, provides the legislature on highly complex issues relating to the system. We still have confidence in MLAC's role, and we will continue to look for ways to improve its functionality and find qualified worker representatives to serve. Another reason we believe the system is imbalanced is due to the division's rulemaking process. As you'll hear, as you've heard today, a very common theme, but a rulemaking process that we believe is very inclusive to all perspectives. There have been some highly controversial workers' comp issues before the legislature in the past few years where employers and worker advocates have not agreed. But the rulemaking processes, from our perspective coming out of those fights, remain fair, open, and inclusive. One final comment on the workers' comp system I'd like to make sure to include it is the incredible value that the Ombudsman, I always screw this up, the Ombudsman ombudsman for injured workers plays as a resource for injured workers who are having difficulty navigating the system. As a worker advocate, I can't stress to you enough how intimidating, overwhelming, and downright scary it can be if you've just been injured on the job and are looking for ways to access your well-deserved workers' comp benefits. This role couldn't be more critical in helping Oregon workers at a time when they need it most. There are clearly other elements and structures within DCBS's and its budget that workers find great value in, obviously Oregon OSHA and its mission, as well as the Building Codes Division, but thank you for the opportunity to offer just some very specific and supportive comments about the Workers' Comp Division's element of the DCBS budget. And thanks for the time.
Thank you all very much. Any questions for this panel? All right. Again, gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us today. That concludes the list of people that I have signed up, but I think there may be some additional people here today that would like to testify. And if you'd like to come on forward, please. Is there anybody else? We've got one chair left. Anybody else who wants to come up? All right. Thank you both. Who would like to go first?
I'll go, I guess. So for the record, Ryan Tribbett here today on behalf of the National Electrical Contractors Association and the Associated Wall and Ceiling Contractors, here to testify in support of the budget, but also to sort of urge this body to sort of treat the Building Codes Division portion of this budget sort of as separate and distinct from the overall because of the fact that it's an other funds agency that's run off of fee revenue from the contractors that I represent. So I'm sort of speaking to you from the position of someone who pays those fees. We believe the department and the Building Codes Division are excellent stewards of our resources. I have a quick story I would like to tell because I think it is sort of emblematic of the way that this agency conducts itself that I think is really sort of special and unique. And that is back when the e-permitting system was created, there was a statutory limitation on the surcharge that could pay for the development of the program. It was set statutorily at 5%. After a few years, the agency looked at it and said, you know what, we're actually able to do this for a lesser amount than 5%. And they came in here and actually passed a law that lowered their fee authority down to 4%. And I don't know how long you guys have been in this process, but I've been involved about 15 years, and I've never seen an agency come in and do that sort of as a check on their own authority to keep themselves honest. And I think that is really unique for the way the Building Codes Division operates. And so you take that type of example, it isn't just one example in isolation. When the recession hit and the housing market sort of really dried up, they saw the writing on the wall. They saw the fee revenue being declined, and they knew there wasn't the need for the service level out there in the industry. And so they proactively, without any urging from this legislature, they cut their own positions back to be good stewards of our money. And what happened then, though, in that whole session is they got wrapped up in the same conversation as the rest of the general fund agencies when this body cut back the vacant positions that were available. And why that was bad for the industry is because when the industry started to pick back up and permits were starting to get pulled at a greater basis, and that's economic development happening. I mean, it was really exciting. We want to service this as fast as we can. But what happened was this legislature locked in an artificially low service level that this agency is able to do in terms of inspections and license enforcement and things like that. It actually artificially slowing the ability for economic development to take root and to come out of the recession. And so we've never been able to get those positions back. We've been paying the fees on these greater level of permits and whatnot, but we're actually not able to get the service level that the agency can provide and wants to provide because of this artificial limitation that's put in place. So I just want to testify in support of the budget and support of the agency's work and their great fiscal prudence that they lead themselves by. And I really do urge and beg you to treat them differently and allow them to provide the services that our contractors pay good money for. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Linda Nilsen. I'm the executive director of Project Access Now. We're a community health nonprofit primarily functioning in the Portland metro area. Our mission is to improve our community's health by creating access to care and services for those most in need. We're actually celebrating our 10th year this year. We started out, our work was around coordinating donated care for the uninsured. And you remember 10 years ago, there were a lot of uninsured people. So as things have moved forward with the Affordable Care Act, we've been in this unique position of saying, do we actually need to go away? Because there aren't going to be as many uninsured. Well, the first piece of news is there are still plenty of uninsured. And the second piece of news is that as we build new systems and bring new things into community, the importance of connecting and networks within community is really important. So we found a place for ourselves, and this is the way we interact with DCBS is connected to how do we take health insurance and make sure we're getting people connected to the right type of health insurance that's affordable for them. So we say in our business that coverage does not necessarily equal access, and access does not necessarily mean equal health. But I will tell you that if you have coverage, you're way far ahead of everybody else in that process. So it's been really important for us to be able to work with. We actually worked with DCBS originally, I think, in 2014 around premium assistance. And there was a time when there were questions about could third-party payers help take care of premium assistance. We've had a premium assistance program for 3.5 years now and have been able to provide hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of care to people who otherwise would not have been able to afford coverage. We, in January 2015, started to do outreach and enrollment for the Oregon Health Plan. Through that, came in touch with Barry Leslie and her staff and became involved in also doing QHP outreach and enrollment, which is more complicated. It also involves another sector, which is the sector of insurance brokers. So one of the things that I feel really I appreciate so much about Barry and her staff is their ability to look at health insurance partners in a community nonprofit. They're two different worlds, and they've been able to bring our worlds together, because ultimately we all want to work, we want to get people covered, we want to do what's right, but systems get set up that are often really complicated. So I've just seen them as being very effective and efficient, as we've talked about, well, that's a great idea in theory, how are we going to actually make that happen in community? They've been really receptive to have conversations and say, and you know, what is it that we're really about? My experience is that it's about getting the job done, and it's about being efficient. I've heard a number of people talk about stewardship today, and I think that's really important because good stewardship means more people get served. So another thing, because of our work with them in last summer, when the Oregon Health Co-op went away in a very short period of time, and there were nearly 10,000 people that were looking at losing coverage, we were asked to kind of come back in and help transition those 10,000. We didn't do all of them by any means. We were one of many approaches and strategies that DCBS, but they had this population they had to get recovered. And in a very short period of time, we're able to cover about almost 90% of those folks, which is very impressive. And they did that through multiple strategies, one of them being working with community partners. So I just obviously am here to support DCBS. I think that we believe as an organization that the answers to the challenges in our community actually live in our community. And the way that we're going to get there, though, is by bringing different levels of policy and implementation together. And the only way we're going to do that is if we have state government that is responsive, that's transparent, and that's inclusive and is able to engage a variety of perspectives. And that has absolutely been our experience, and we want to support their budget.
Well, thank you very much. Any questions, colleagues? All right. Again, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who has anything to share with the committee today? All right. I don't see any final takers, so I'm going to go ahead and conclude the public hearing on 5512. Mr. Stainer, I think that you're going to be leaving us, and of course, the committee will not be back together until Monday. Anything to share with us before you go?
Chair Gomberg, members of the committee. No, I want to tell you I appreciate your time listening to DCBS's budget, and I'm sure I'll be back with you during our work session with the agency's budget. And I think that you guys have been doing a great job listening. Any questions, or if there's anything that LFO can do to help answer any other questions, please feel free to send them to me.
You know, colleagues, while I've got you here, I'll mention you've heard me ask every agency about delinquent debt. Mr. Stainer is the fellow in LFO that's compiling annual reports for us on all of our state agencies, and it's a good read. So I would encourage you to pick up a copy of the reports. I think we're expecting the 2016 report to be coming out fairly soon.
Yes.
So, colleagues, I'll also mention when we reconvene on Monday, we'll be starting with a new agency, but we also have a work session on a grant application that'll be here. So if we can make sure everybody gets here on a timely fashion, we'll be able to move that work session through very quickly. Anything else for the good of the order? All right, some of us are going to be traveling to Ashland and to Eugene for Ways and Means listening sessions. Others are going to be going home early. So if you're in the latter group, enjoy. And if you're in the former group, I will see you on the road. We are adjourned. Thank you.